the bicycle-clipped misanthropist. Alistair Wilson has compiled an impression of Larkin as he is remembered by his close friends and colleagues in Hull.
It's always been a source of mild surprise to me that what society has been prepared to pay me for is being a librarian. There are many better librarians than me in the country.
Philip Larkin's office is on the first floor, so we're up these stairs. Philip Larkin was appointed in 1955. I joined him a couple of years later, and I was with him until 1984, which is a long time.
Any time I met him, and I've eaten with him many times and dined with him and talked with him, I never got this impression of the curmudgeonly old fart.
I think more than anything else, he was a man who made me laugh enormously.
I always remember him as large, and I always remember him with a twinkle in his eye.
He had a wonderful line in obscenity, great, long, well-constructed curses.
It was his size that struck me as much as anything. Just as you see pictures of Boswell and Johnson, and Boswell is always pictured as the slight figure he was, but Johnson was a towering Staffordshire man with his great big stick stalking round the Hebrides or the Stews of Seven Dials or Edinburgh, wherever they were together. There was this kind of ruggedness about him, really. He was a very big man.
This was my room. It says librarian on the door. But, of course, I was the dragon that fettered everybody who came to see him.
I think Hull was a very convenient place for him to be. It was off the beaten track. He wasn't easily get-at-able by people from London or people passing up and down the country, because we are out on a limb. And I think Hull suited his general image very well. He did not want to be involved with the London literary scene.
You see, he has three doors in his room. One door between to his secretary, but the other two were escape doors if he thought he didn't want to see anybody. Or if out of the window he saw somebody was coming into the library whom he didn't want to see, he would take the other door out and up into the stack to look for a book.
When he first came to Hull, he was shy. He had quite a bad stammer. He just didn't like being lionised. I don't think he liked the interruption into his privacy. Therefore, it suited him very well, I think, to stay here.
Swerving east from rich industrial shadows and traffic all night north, swerving through fields too thin and thistle to be called meadows, and now and then a harsh-named halt that shields workmen at dawn, swerving to solitude of skies and scarecrows, haystacks, hares and pheasants, and the widening river's slow presence, the piled gold clouds, the shining gull-marked mud, gathers to the surprise of a large town.
He loved the loneliness of this area. You know, in fact, you had a large city and yet very, very quickly could get out into the country. He loved the loneliness of Holderness. It is an extraordinary place in that in summertime particularly, you can go down roads and never be able to find them again. I know I've driven down country lanes in Holderness with Philip on summer evenings, you know, when everything's in full leaf, and I've tried to find them again and I couldn't. It is an extraordinary place like that.
Here, silence stands like heat. Here, leaves unnoticed thicken. Hidden weeds flower. Neglected waters quicken. Luminously peopled air ascends. And past the poppy's bluish neutral distance, ends the land suddenly, beyond the beach of shapes and shingle. Here is unfenced existence, facing the sun, untalkative, out of reach.
His mode of dress was always rather sober and serious. Indeed, on occasion, I thought he looked like a very conventional bank manager, shall we say, in the City of London. One often had a predominant impression of black and waistcoats and a watch chain.
I met him when he was 30, and when he died at gone 60, he was still wearing the same sort of small check tweed jackets, very well-pressed trousers and highly polished size 12 shoes. The size 12 shoes always amazed me. I can remember going into his bedroom and seeing three pairs of size 12s. I didn't know anyone wore size 12s, you know. It amazed me.
He, being a large man, went to the high and mighty shops and was always complaining about the fact that if you have a modern shirt, it just about comes down into the waistband, and any movement, hey presto, it's hanging out. And one of his great dictums about a good shirt was it should be arse-covered and balls-covered. He gave up trying to buy them off the shelf and went to a shirt maker's in the West End eventually.
What leavened the rather sober appearance, I think, was the bright socks. Petunia or orange. It was the one touch of levity. And late on in his life, I said, Philip, you don't seem to wear the bright socks that you used to. Oh, he said, they all went the same colour in the wash.
Oh, you sorted dog.
He liked the things that he probably first cut his jazz ears on. The Armstrongs, Hot Fives and Sevens, Bics, the King Oliver Band, the excitement of Benny Moten. He had an enormous affection for Wild Bill Davidson, the trumpeter who led a lot of Condon's bands. Sidney Bechet. Tremendous enthusiasm for that. Bechet and people of his ilk. Certainly, he used to turn up on my doorstep unannounced with a sheepish grin, saying he felt like playing a few records, and then would come in and stay for a couple of hours or a whole evening or late into the night. He couldn't possibly sit still when the Count Basie Orchestra was in full flight, almost capering. Outside himself, completely, I mean, like a fat jitterbug, if you like. In fact, one of my children once did come down and complain about the noise we were making.
His desk, he had various objects. The most important one was the toad. This toad was a large creature. I think it was given to him by George Hartley, his first publisher.
He was a first-rate librarian.
He was a superb administrator, and work meant a great deal to him.
I think he was a very good organiser, a good administrator, and a good leader.
There were two areas where he felt tremendously confident, and one was as an administrator, and the other was as a poet, but as a public person, no, he did not feel confident.
At the beginning of session, he always had to address the students. And he always used to say, this is the worst day of my life. I said, that's impossible. You had the worst day of your life last week when so-and-so happened. But we were always having the worst day of my life. He was very, very nervous about addressing people. His hands were wet.
with the tension. Always. He said, feel my hand. And it was wet. It wasn't just damp. That's how nervous he was about public occasions. And this is why, he said, well, this is why I became a librarian, and I'm not a tutor. I'm not a lecturer. I'm a librarian, so I don't have to do these public things. And on this table by the window, he had a framed photograph of Guy the Gorilla. He admired this creature very much. I think he himself thought that he was a prisoner, as Guy was. He was a librarian, but I think he would have wished to earn his living totally by his writing. He used to say, well, I go home at night, I get my supper, I wash up, and then the day begins. I start my writing.
Why should I let the toad work squat on my life? Can't I use my wit as a pitchfork and drive the brute off? 6 days of the week it soils with its sickening poison just for paying a few bills. That's out of proportion. Lots of folk live on their wits. Lecturers, lispers, losels, loblolly men, louts. They don't end as paupers.
Poe is very funny stuff, you know.
Fires in a bucket.
Sometimes he would write something right off. Sometimes it would take him not weeks but years.
He was extremely craftsmanly. There would be the idea, and the rest would be hard slog, and perhaps a lot of consulting of rhyming dictionaries and encyclopedias and that kind of thing. And he would consult experts in particular fields to find out what particular technical terms meant.
Yes, I gave him some words. Their final blazon. I gave him blazon. He said, now, stop that. Shut up. I'm doing something here. I need a word. A word of two syllables. About heraldry. And he's biting my head off, you know. And then I said, would blazon do? Blazon would do very well. A final blazon I shall write. A bit of alliteration never does any harm. And then he was sweet as could be when he'd done it. And I gave him losel, because he wanted to say lazars. And I said, well, lazars are just poor lepers. You can't say that. He wanted another L, you know. A bit of alliteration never does any harm. I said, well, I'll give you one with two L's then. Losel. You've been to Oxford, you've read Pierce Plowman, haven't you? He said, yes, yes, I have. He put that in.
You say that so many of the poems are negative, but he said he could only write when he was unhappy, and so the gloom comes out.
They fuck you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had, and add some extra just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by fools in old-style hats and coats who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself.
The public image was of a very miserable private man, but the times that I saw him at the university were usually over lunch hours with a group of friends around the bar, and that certainly isn't a very private and morose sort of man. There was this tremendous sense of humour that he had.
He was a very amusing man, very witty. One of his acts, which not many people have seen, was his mime representation of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Now, nobody who's seen the public persona that's been projected of Philip Larkin would believe that he would do a thing like this.
Part of his entertainment value was that he had this wonderful clown-like face. You know, the heavy jowls gave him that India rubber quality so that he could pull his face into all kinds of wonderful shapes and mimic just about anyone's accent.
He could mimic all kinds of people, and he used to come back from Senate meetings and he used to give a resume. He used to mimic the various people who spoke and what they said and one thing and another. Terrific sense of humour.
My wife and I have asked a crowd of craps to come and waste their time and ours. Perhaps you'd care to join us.
In a pig's arse, friend. Funny how hard it is to be alone. I could spend half my evenings, if I wanted, holding a glass of washing sherry, canted over to catch the drivel of some bitch who's read nothing but witch. Just think of all the spare time that has flown straight into nothingness by being filled with forks and faces.
He had a very rich private life with lots of friends and lots of acquaintances. He was by no means a hermit, but he didn't want his life to be full of people who were hunting him simply because he had a reputation as a poet.
I mean, the British Council were always writing, saying, we have Mr. somebody or other from Bangladesh, a librarian, always a librarian from somewhere or other. Please, can they meet you? And I had a standard letter, and it reminded them, you know, that Philip Larkin does not interview British Council's protégé. In the end, they stopped asking him.
He was besieged by admirers in the sense of telephone calls at all hours of the day and night, teachers wanting interpretations of some of his poems.
Yes, well, I've been going through some of his letters, and they are full of that sort of thing. And he would write back and say, if it was Wordsworth, you couldn't know, you'd have to do it yourself. Do it now.
The world is treating me bad, misery.
In his 40s, he was a very jolly, outgoing person. He was much sought after for parties, and in the 60s in Hull, in those days when the university was expanding, there were an awful lot of parties.
I won't see her no more. It's gonna be a drag, misery.
It was the era of the Beatles. He was always dancing to Beatles records. Philip couldn't dance. He asked me to teach him. I tried to, but it wasn't very successful. He would just shuffle around, really rather awkwardly. And he used to say that I was the only person he could dance with. I knew how to avoid his feet.
Sexual intercourse began in 1963, which was rather late for me, between the end of the Chatterley Band and the Beatles' first LP. Up till then, there'd only been a sort of bargaining, a wrangle for a ring, a shame that started at 16 and spread to everything. Then, all at once, the quarrel sank. Everyone felt the same. And every life became a brilliant breaking of the bank, a quite unlosable game.
I think he was, and would admit, that he was always an admirer of young women. Now, when I first knew him, he was situated in a room which was near the path along which most of the students used to pass, and his desk was conveniently placed near the window. On his desk he kept a spyglass, specifically for looking at talent as it passed. And we would interrupt the proceedings for a few moments while he lifted his spyglass to his eye and admired the passing students, particularly the young and pretty female ones. And he always referred to these as honeys. He was very fond of honeys.
He did like large ladies, well-built ladies, the sort of Bessie Smith type of lady. The sort of ladies you get on the Damart thermal underwear catalogues, the sort of moulded and harmonious ladies. He admired them greatly.
Yes, yes, oh, he was fascinated by women. He'd say things like, oh, I wish you could get sex and pay for it monthly, like you do the laundry. Because it's all so difficult. And you get a girl and she seems to be interested in you and you invite her back and you spend pots of money on caviar and champagne and you've got the lights low and the music playing and then just as you go in for the clinch, she starts telling you about this bloke she's engaged to. Oh, God, it's all such a pain. And he'd talk about having seen a colleague, a lecturer, come out of a classroom with his arm round some very toothsome female student. I bet he's having it off with her. He'd say, lucky sod.
He did have depressions. Those are the days when I had to sit, keep the door shut between us, and he used to just brood.
What do they think has happened, the old fools, to make them like this? Do they somehow suppose it's more grown up when your mouth hangs open and drools and you keep on pissing yourself and can't remember who called this morning? Or that, if they only chose, they could alter things back to when they danced all night, or went to their wedding, or sloped arms some September. Or do they fancy there's really been no change, and they've always behaved as if they were crippled, or tight, or sat through days of thin, continuous dreaming, watching light move?
Underlying all is this deep sense of gloom, and this very morbid idea of death. We talked a great deal about death.
He did fear death. One time he smoked a lot, and I said, well, I can't understand a man who fears death smoking. I said, you ought to be trying to prolong life if you fear death so much. But he said, I don't understand you. He said, why don't you, when you wake up in the morning, your first thought be about death? He and John Betjeman, they used to write letters to each other about death and how they felt about it and how awful it was and everything.
At death, you break up. The bits that were you start speeding away from each other forever with no one to see. It's only oblivion, true. We had it before, but then it was going to end, and was all the time merging with a unique endeavour to bring to bloom the million-petaled flower of being here. Next time, you can't pretend there'll be anything else. And these are the first signs. Not knowing how, not hearing who, the power of choosing gone.
It always surprised me that he was so concerned about dying. But I think it was because he was such a sensitive man and felt life on his senses, that would be the great loss to him. And, of course, his deafness must have exacerbated these feelings. That was one of the senses that started going quite quickly, of course. And he said that the first time he realised he was deaf was when he couldn't hear the birds sing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
he was getting increasingly cut off. His pleasures were being withdrawn from him. I mean, when he had a bad day, he'd ring up and say, oh, another step down Cemetery Road.
A few years before he died, I said to him, how's the book coming, Philip? What book, he said. So I said, well, you know, every 10 years you do one, don't you? And he said, well, you know how I usually have about 6 or 7 really good strong ones and 15 or so fillers. So I said, yes. He said, well, I've got the 15 fillers. And it seemed as though he couldn't find the big theme anymore or the lengthy exploration.
Certainly, I think his friends and admirers were always trying to persuade him, you know, isn't it time we had something more from you? But his skills were to well-turned library minutes.
He talked to my friend Ted Tarling about it, and Ted said that he saw him once in terrible anguish, sort of thumping the arm of the chair and saying, I can't do it, I just can't do it anymore. It's gone.
It's been announced that Ted Hughes has been appointed Poet Laureate. The Yorkshire-born poet, whose full name is Edward James Hughes, succeeds Sir John Betjeman, who died earlier this year. The Poet Laureate, who becomes a member of the Queen's household, is expected to produce verse on state occasions.
Hughes, he was offered it, and he refused it, because he wasn't writing any poetry, but more, I think. He said, you've got to be Mr. Poetry. Now, Dolly O'Betters had made it such a scene. And Philip said he couldn't do that. That's all he said. I'm not going to be Mr. Poetry. But I can tell you, Mrs. Thatcher wrote him a very nice letter when he refused. I should have been very proud if he'd been Poet Laureate. I told him that. I said, well, I should be very proud if you would. He said, well, so should I. But not so. He would have been cross if he hadn't been offered it to.
His father died of cancer at the age of 63, and Philip always said that he himself would die of cancer at the age of 63.
He had said to me, before he went into hospital at the very beginning, don't tell me what I've got. He thought he had got what he had got. And he said, supposing I've got cancer. He was sitting in this chair. I was sitting with him. But then he said, supposing I've got this, how long would you give me? But I couldn't lie to him then. I said 6 months. And he said, oh, is that all?
He was just part of my life for 10 years, and we did get very, very close indeed. And so the things that strike you most are his not being there. The worst thing about it is walking into the library and knowing you're not going to meet him.
Bicycle Clipped Misanthropist featured the voices of Michael Bowen, Maeve Brennan, Donald Campbell, John Chappell, Eddie Dawes, Jean Hartley, Anthony Hedges, Monica Jones and Betty McKerith. The programme was compiled and produced by Alistair Wilson.